Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. It is lockdown Easter and it's eerily quiet out there on the streets of London today as Boris Johnson begins his recovery from a near-death experience last week. Yesterday, he was allowed home from hospital and he is currently recuperating at Chequers with his partner, Carrie Simmons. But the hatred and bile from the left continues. The health editor of The Economist, Chris Lockwood, even suggested that the Prime Minister had never actually been ill. He's now had to issue an apology and a retraction. Apparently, he says he made a mistake. And as the media narrative about PPE changes, thanks to several reality checks over the weekend, some people are still attempting to make political capital out of the NHS staff. The BBC on Sunday morning could barely contain their disappointment after interviewing a doctor and two nurses who all said that protection for them was not an issue and never had been. The truth of the matter is that the supply and demand is not dovetailing in every single location of the health business. But the narrative that is being pumped out by the health unions like the BMA and the Royal College of Nursing is one thing only: political propaganda. Nobody in their right mind would expect NHS workers to put their lives at risk. And it's now time to stop feeding the beast that suggests the government doesn't care. As Boris Johnson said yesterday, he is indebted to the NHS for saving his life. We'll get the latest from the front lines coming up. We'll be speaking to doctors. We'll be speaking to all sorts of people throughout the show. 0344 499 1000 is the number. Also, we're going to have round two of my prize fight with the Mail on Sunday columnist Peter Hitchens. Peter was on last week bemoaning the restrictions on our liberty and questioning the coronavirus strategy coming out of Downing Street. We'll see if recent developments have done anything to change his mind. Also, we'll be touching upon the latest news coming out of Malibu, where Harry and Meghan are holed up feeling terribly sorry for themselves. Oh dear, you know what I'm going to do next. 0344 499 1000. And as ever, we are live streaming on YouTube, Facebook and Twitter. We want to hear from you, what you were seeing on your doorstep this weekend, what you're hearing when you're out and about. And with the news that Spain is beginning to lift its lockdown, tell us where we should be going next and exactly how is that all going to work. 0344 499 1000. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
So a whole series of news stories to discuss. I couldn't believe, first of all, how busy London streets were on Friday, where it was Good Friday, it was a holiday. I couldn't believe how quiet the traffic was coming into work, because basically if people who are working are supposed to be essential workers, how come they're not working on a bank holiday? It would appear a lot of people are not working today either, because it is also a bank holiday. Because the weather's not so nice, not so many people are out and about. I've never seen so many joggers in my life on Saturday. I've never seen so many cyclists in my life as I did on Saturday. And I'm afraid that if people do not get the idea that social distancing is not just a request, but in fact a necessity and an instruction, then this is going to go on for an awful lot longer than you would think it should do. Let's talk to Dr. Lawrence Gurlis, who is, of course, London GP at Same Day. Dr. Lawrence, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Yeah, I'm okay. How are you doing?
Good. Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you. Yes.
Good man. I was slightly distressed, I'd have to say, on Saturday, which is my one sort of shopping day of the week. I go to Borough Market and pick up some stuff for the rest of the week. And I saw one of the stall holders there who said on Good Friday, Borough Market was almost as busy as it ever was. You know, on Saturday morning when I go, there's hardly anybody there. But it was very busy, he said, on Friday. And not one person who was inside the place was practising social distancing.
Yeah, it's very worrying. And it's a lot of young people who think they're immune. They're clearly not.
Right.
People in denial. There's still an attitude going around. I've heard people say to me, oh, you know, people die of flu every year. These numbers are horrific, but people die every day. That's not the case. This is a very nasty virus,
yes,
as we know. It's highly contagious. That's got some unusual features. It spreads very quickly in droplets in the air.
Yeah.
It's extremely virulent. It kills people. And it's also a highly resistant virus, so it can last for 72 hours in droplets on plastic surfaces. And that, those are three features that combine to make this a perfect storm of a very nasty virus. So anyone that's ignoring that is putting their own lives at risk, but more importantly, the lives of others as well.
Yes, exactly right. But also, what is this thing that we seem to have? I mean, I saw a video at the weekend of one of my listeners who lives in one of the Balearic Islands, I think, in Spain, said, this is what a lockdown looks like, and he's panning around the streets of a very busy, what you would call a sort of tourist spot, if you like, and there's literally nobody out, no one, not a person, yeah. Not a dog, yeah. Not a cyclist, not a jogger, nothing. I mean, that's what we need, isn't it?
Well, possibly. I mean, if this goes on, I mean, I'm hoping the numbers are coming down and we are seeing a flattening of the curve. But if we don't, we're going to, excuse me, I'm okay. If we don't, we're going to have to tighten up on the restrictions because people aren't taking it seriously. A number of people are still having barbecues, still having house parties, still going round to friends to visit their homes. It's horrible, Mike. And I just really wish for everyone's sake people just follow it just for another 2 or 3 weeks and then we could gradually release the lockdown.
Yes, because I think...
Sometime in May.
Yes, because I think that with places like Spain starting to move towards a lifting of something, and it would appear that they're going to do construction workers first, if people can see that maybe there is an end in sight, perhaps they will behave better.
Possibly. The other worrying thing is if the message goes out that there's a partial lifting of the lockdown, say for schools or construction workers, the worry then is that people will just see that, oh, it's all over, and they'll behave even worse rather than better. That's my concern.
Right.
And I'm sure the government have factored that in. Any message that somehow we're winning and people will just misbehave even more. That's my concern.
Right. And what about some other developments that we've seen over the last few days? In South Korea, for example, there's talk of people who they thought had tested positive and had then got over the virus now testing positive again. There seems to be some doubt about how that's happened. It could be that they were testing in some way incorrectly because they don't think they've got the virus again. They think it's just kind of reappeared.
Yeah, we've actually started doing some antibody tests. And there's a few things that are coming out. Some people are slow to produce antibodies. We've got one of our doctors who definitely clinically had the virus, but she hasn't got any antibodies. Now, the question is, can she catch it again because she's got no immunity? There's a lot we don't know about this virus. There's a lot we don't know about the immune response. And the other worrying thing is, if that's the case, we don't even know that a vaccine would work because maybe not everyone's going to develop immunity to the vaccine. And maybe even if you produce antibodies, you can still catch the virus again.
Yeah.
So we're learning all the time. I'm getting a much better handle on it. I'm actually a bit more confident. I think most people will eventually produce antibodies.
Yes.
But for some reason, they produce them very slowly. And that's what we're seeing in our testing.
Yes. I mean, there's no doubt that as this goes on, we should feel more confident, you know, rather than less confident, even though there's still a lot that we don't know. But what I'm slightly puzzled by is if what you've just said is true, i.e. that some people may still have to be infected more than once, How do you manage, or how do you stage manage the lifting of the restrictions in a place like Spain?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, this is a question of hoping for a bit of herd immunity.
Yes.
If 30 to 50% of the population can have some immunity, that will stop the spread of the virus. And that was the hope several weeks ago when we thought this was no worse than flu and that you could get it without symptoms. And maybe you'd be immune without knowing it. That was the hope. Now, that seems not to be the case. Most of the people we're finding who have had the virus know they've had it. We're detecting very few people who've had mild symptoms and then develop antibodies. But I do think that we're learning about this new plasma treatment. We're looking at drugs like hydroxychloroquine in combination with other medications. So we are looking at treatments. There will be a vaccine. I hope it's, you know, in the autumn rather than next year.
Yeah.
And hopefully that vaccine has some effect in producing antibodies and protecting us. So we're learning more all the time. And I'm generally optimistic. I'm just looking at the figures every day. And what's worrying is I didn't think we'd be as bad as Italy, but I think we are.
Yes, and some are saying we may end up being the worst country in Europe. But I was looking at some other statistics from Statista.com at the weekend, which is about deaths per million, right? Yeah. And we're not brilliant, it has to be said, but we're not as bad as Spain or Italy or Belgium or France or the Netherlands or Switzerland.
Yeah, I was looking at that as well. Netherlands have done particularly badly, actually, and that's interesting. I think they took a fairly relaxed view at the beginning, a very liberal society, much like ours. And I think that's probably the issue there.
Yes.
But you're right. I saw those figures, and we're not doing that badly. It's just the numbers. The numbers are horrific, Mike.
Yeah.
You know, 700, 800, 900 a day. It's too many. We've got to see that coming down.
And why are we being affected so badly? Can you put your finger on why that is?
I think we're a crowded country.
Mm.
London's a big city. You think of other countries, you know, everyone's telling us that Sweden's doing very well, but it's much less crowded than we are.
Yes.
And I think that's really one of the issues. We live in close communities. I was travelling on the tube until recently.
Yeah.
And I think that is a factor. We're a social society. I think, Spain and Italy have cafe societies. We have a pub culture.
Yeah.
So we're very social. Young people go out 7 nights a week, They don't just go out on a Friday night anymore.
Right.
And I think those are the factors.
And the other thing is, for people who don't go out, which is what we're still seeing up and down the country, there's an awful lot of sort of house parties going on, you know?
Yeah, we're sociable. We go around to friends, we go around to families. That's where Easter has been a bit of a challenge. But I think, by and large, people have treated Easter well. I think the Prime Minister's illness shocked a lot of people into behaving a bit better. What I'm hoping is they don't take the view now, well, he's got over it, so that's okay. So I am worried about relaxing the lockdown, because I think people would just say, right, that's it. I've done my 4 weeks.
Yeah.
I'll go back to what I was doing before.
Mm. But in terms of, for example, lifting the ban on construction workers, which is, I believe, what they're going to attempt to do in Spain or in parts of Spain, does that really work? Because if they do that, presumably there will be suppliers who will then be activated from other parts of the country or from, neighbouring communities, so that suddenly by just opening one door, if you like, it opens a lot more of similar doors.
Well, I think all of these things have unintended consequences. You think about, are you going to open some of the shops?
Yeah.
Which shops? Are the shops going to have social distancing rules in the way the supermarkets have at the moment?
Yeah. Some people have been saying this, that, you're worrying about the people who are going into parks and you're worrying about people who are, jogging and cycling and all of that. But yet people are still going into supermarkets and walking quite close to one another while they're in there.
Yeah, and closed spaces.
I mean, I've stopped going to supermarkets, quite frankly.
Yeah, I have as well. I think closed spaces are actually more worrying.
Yeah.
I feel more at risk going to a supermarket than going to work and seeing patients, quite frankly.
Really?
You're standing in a queue, there's other people. And we know that if someone's in a room and they breathe out this virus, that virus hangs around in droplets for 3 hours after they've left the room.
Right.
I mean, for heaven's sake, that's really worrying.
Mm. And we don't yet know, really, do we, how long this kind of incubation period might be. For example, if I was in contact with somebody who had it back at the beginning of March, but I still haven't had a problem up to now, it doesn't mean I won't have a problem in the next 2 weeks or month, maybe.
I think that's unlikely. We're looking, from the cases I've seen, 5-6 days, maybe up to a maximum 14 days is the incubation period.
Right.
But yes, that's quite a long time. And it means that you won't know for a while, and in the meantime, you could be contagious and passing it on to other people. But I think you're okay from the beginning of March to now, Mike.
Yeah.
So you just got to be careful.
Yes, absolutely. And I can't understand people who are not careful, who just don't seem to understand that this is what you should do. When I was in Borough Market on Friday, on Saturday, I was in this particular stall where they make a very nice sausage en sec, I must say, and some cheese. And as I'm standing talking to the guy and about to pay, a woman came in and was about to brush past me to go and get something. And he said to her, "Excuse me, madam, it's one person at a time. It's a very clear sign outside the shop." And she looked at him as if he'd just stolen her handbag. And this is what he said to me about Borough Market. And he was the same guy who said to me, on Friday, people were just, whole families were coming in. I was asking them, please, to just come in one at a time. Yeah. They were like, "But we're all one family. It's fine." And it's like, well, it's not fine.
Yeah. No, look, I mean, the other thing is I'm wearing a mask now. I mean, there's been a lot of stuff said about masks. Do they work? Don't they? I feel much more comfortable wearing a mask. We know the virus lives in droplets that people cough out. I don't want to be coughing onto other people, and I don't want other people coughing droplets onto me.
And the good thing about a mask is that it dilutes, if you are going to become infected by an outpouring of it, the mask will dilute that amount, won't it? Which we know is better.
Yeah. And you get a lower viral load, and there does seem to be some evidence the initial viral load correlates with the severity of the illness as things get worse. So, no, we have made mistakes about masks. I mean, masks are simple and cheap to make. We should have been making millions of them a month ago, and everyone should have access to them, not just the people in the hospitals, but I think the population should wear masks. And I would say we should release the lockdown if people can go out wearing masks. But probably the answer to that is, well, we can't get hold of the masks.
Right. Yeah, I mean, apparently Spain is producing something like 10 million masks to give to people as they try and lift the lockdown slightly. So, I mean, what are you making of this whole argument about PPE? Because people are getting their knickers in a right old twist about it, you know, because it would seem as though, you know, there are shortages in areas and there are some problems with supply and demand in some places. But by and large, certainly all the ICU units have got proper materials, as we learned over the weekend. Yeah. And I just would hope and wish that some organisations like the BMA and the Royal College of Nursing would not try and sort of push this narrative that it's all a shambles and the government hasn't got a clue what it's doing.
Well, the BMA is a trade union, and that's their job, to act on behalf of their members. Yeah. You know, people often think the BMA is a learned body that's making medical pronouncements. It is, but it's basically a trade union.
Yeah, right.
They're just doing their job. I think there were problems. I think those problems were severe in some places. They seem to me largely have been solved.
Yeah.
But I do think that we missed a trick. I mean, I know antibody testing, throat swab testing is one thing, but producing millions of masks, that should have been easy, and we should have been doing that right at the beginning of this. And I'm not aware. You hear stories about ventilators being made by Hoover manufacturers, or Dyson or whatever. But I just want to see more masks being made and being made available.
Right.
I went into my local pharmacy and they quoted me £2 for a mask that probably costs about 3p to make. And that's disgraceful. Masks should be available to everyone in small quantities, free of charge, so we go out and about, and that would help the lockdown. I'm sure that would make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely right. And what do you make of the Holby City connection? I don't know if you saw this story at the end of last week. I mean, what the hell is the BBC doing with real ventilators, right? And if they did have them, why did they wait for 3.5 weeks to hand them over?
I think they probably didn't realise. I think someone probably woke up.
But that's amazing, isn't it? I mean, I don't know how much does a ventilator cost?
And why can't the props people make a fake ventilator for use on home water? No, they had real ventilators there. Horrific, really, isn't it?
I mean, Miami Vice managed to make a fake Lamborghini Countach and put it on the body of a Pontiac Firebird. You know, surely they don't need a real ventilator.
No, but clearly they had, and at least they've donated them. But I'm
unbelievable.
The next Holby story, when someone comes in, they're not going to get a ventilator now. Maybe they'll just let them die on Holby City.
Well, maybe so. Unbelievable. Incredible. Dr. Lawrence Gurlis, thank you very much indeed. Good luck. Continued good luck and continued success and continued good health is what we can say to everybody that we talk to today. 0344 499 1000. Don't forget, we need your eyes and ears, please, because I want to know what's going on out there. How are the police getting along? How are you getting along with the police? How are you getting along with being cooped up over Easter weekend? It's not such a nice day today, so I imagine the streets will be a little bit quieter. But my goodness me, it was absolutely rammed in London on Friday. And one of the reasons, as Dr. Lawrence Gurlis just said there, why Britain is doing probably slightly worse than some other countries in terms of the large numbers is it's a very overcrowded country. I think we know that, don't we?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Without further ado, let us welcome Mr. Peter Hitchens back into the Independent Republic. Peter, very good morning to you.
A very good morning to you too, and a blessed Easter to you.
Well, indeed, it's been quite a strange Easter, hasn't it?
But very strange.
But you know, Boris Johnson being resurrected on Sunday, I suppose, was entirely in keeping with the narrative at the moment.
I think, actually, in so many ways, I don't think I'll join in that particular form of levity, if you forgive me.
No, fair enough. Let's.
We're all pleased that the Prime Minister is recovering. I think I'd say that for certain, and I'm very pleased that that he is recovering, and of course, all our sympathies go to those families and individuals which have been affected by disease at what would otherwise be a hopeful time.
Absolutely right. Let's see whether we can start with a question by me to you about things that may have changed since we spoke last Monday. You were particularly talking about various countries that have performed better than we had. We're seeing in Sweden now perhaps a little bit of a tighter situation happening. We're seeing in South Korea that things may not always be as they seem. I shall say to you now that I made a mistake by saying to you that the death rate in Japan was very high, which it isn't. So I got that wrong. However, it may become higher than it currently is. And it also looks as though in Spain, the lockdown may be beginning to be lifted. So what are your observations from the past few days?
Well, I continue to say what I said from the start, which is that there is no evidence at all that these economic shutdowns and attacks on personal liberty actually reduced the incidence of death from COVID-19. There's a very interesting piece, in fact, which anyone can study on the web today, by Yinon Weiss, which I don't know, those with great mathematical skills may disagree with it, but it certainly posits the fact that you can't find any correlation, particularly in the United States, which you studied in detail, between the onset of shutdowns and the death rates in the various states involved. And a similar attempt to correlate it with school closures doesn't work either. And this is what I've said from the start, that the presumption that's made in this debate by those in favor of the shutdown is that the shutdown will save lives, and therefore those who oppose it are callous about human life. And this isn't so. It is a presumption. And again, there's a second fascinating article by Professor John Lee in the Spectator under the title of Understanding COVID Needs Open Minds and Vigorous Debate, in which he also attacks this presumption that the shutdown will lead to fewer deaths. We simply don't have any information from any of these countries to suggest that it is in itself effective. I would say that if looking at Sweden, and the last figures from Sweden before the Easter break really got underway with 17 had died, I've urged caution on those figures because at holiday times the collection of such figures is always difficult. So let's wait and see. But what certainly doesn't seem to have happened in Sweden so far, and one must add so far to anything one says, is the huge number of deaths which would have been produced if one had been using the Imperial College model. Absolutely nothing remotely resembling it. So I think that we are in a position where, at the moment, all the governments in Europe are beginning to wonder whether they got this right. And I think what many people need to read is the fascinating article in the Daily Telegraph last Friday, I think, by Fraser Nelson, the editor of The Spectator, which plainly came as a result of some extremely high-level briefings in which he made it clear that the government was deeply split about what to do next and had been astonished by just how effective its appeal to the public had been, and has in a way created a monster. Mm. That is to say, we have an immensely well-intentioned and self-disciplined public in this country who, having been persuaded by the government of this great peril, has behaved with extraordinary self-control over the past 3 weeks, and has also accepted without question an economic shutdown, which is costing the equivalent of £2.4 billion a day. That's six modern new general hospitals a day,
yes,
if you like to put it that way.
Right.
Accepting that, and the government is increasingly doubtful as to whether it's actually done the right thing, but it's created such strong public support for the action that it's very difficult for them to now climb down.
And, well, right.
But you note that in Italy, which has been where it's been suggested that the shutdown has been a rational response and that it's been very serious, that in Italy and in Spain, the governments are again beginning to grope for ways to at least sidle out of the position into which they've got themselves because of the colossal economic and social damage
Yes. Can I just pop in there?
No, that's where I was going to stop.
That's
my main statement. After that, let's just keep it a brief exchange.
Yes. Brief exchange. Absolutely. Here's a couple of things that I would say about that. I was talking to a doctor this morning, and I asked him, why is it, do you think, that Britain's death rate is as high as it is? Because it is unusually high compared to other countries. He said he believes it's because of the fact that Britain is quite a crowded country compared to a place like Sweden, where there are fewer people around. And he also said, as Boris Johnson did when he left hospital yesterday, that, you know, staying away from each other, social distancing, is the way to stop this virus from spreading so quickly that it overwhelms the NHS. And that's basically why they're doing it. And they say that people can go out, but they cannot crowd around each other. They cannot have mass meetings. They cannot go to football matches, all that sort of thing. But he also said that what we now know is that if somebody sneezes with this virus, it can literally hang in the air for 3 hours. You know, so the only seemingly straight answer for me to get past this is to have a long enough period of time where people are literally not going about their daily business and they are only going outside for essential work and essential, you know, food shopping and that kind of thing. Because if we don't do that, I think it will never stop spreading.
Well, can I offer some counters to all those points?
Yeah.
First of all, in Sweden, yes, of course, if you simply take population versus square mileage, it's not as crowded as Britain. But friends of mine who live in Sweden will point out that it is a very urbanised country, mm-hmm. and that certainly in Stockholm particularly, the density of population is quite comparable to that in London. So I don't think that argument particularly works. On the overstretching of the NHS, it's very interesting. Again, I've tried to get information from people I know who work in the NHS, and what they say is that what's happened now is that so much of the NHS estate has been turned over to effectively intensive care provision that almost the whole of the rest of the NHS is not functioning at all. People are not going to hospitals, they're not calling doctors, and many things are not being done. So I'm not entirely sure what the pressure is on the NHS. One of the consequences of this is that the normal published statistics on the usage and pressure on intensive care are not being published. I think there is a reasonable, unsinister reason for this, which is, as I say, it simply isn't comparable because of the huge amount of emergency intensive care provision which has now been set up, so they wouldn't really mean very much. Mm. But I think that if we did have or could have any measure of what was going on, I'm not sure that this argument that intensive care was under colossal unsustainable pressure would stand up. And then again, we get back to the same old point. There is still no evidence that the shutdown measures are actually affecting the numbers dying. The other thing about the British, and indeed some of the other national figures for coronavirus deaths, remains at the point originally made, again, by Dr. John Lee. What are we actually measuring? Are we measuring people who have died from coronavirus, or are we measuring people who have died, who have actually been infected with coronavirus, or have been, in some cases, presumed to be infected with coronavirus? And if we are, then how reliable are these measures? As far as I've been able to discover, and I'm not a statistical genius, and I fully admit this, trying to find out the number of deaths over and above what they would normally be expected to be at this time of year on a five-year average, it seems to be, as far as I can discover, again, about 1,000 a week. That's roughly 144 per day. Now, this is obviously tragic in every case, and to be mourned and regretted as all avoidable, and indeed unavoidable deaths are, but it's not enormous.
No, I get that.
It's not at the stage of pandemic which we're being told about.
Yeah, but this is one of the difficulties, I think, with all of the figures that we're looking at, because none of us are statisticians. The people who are the statisticians are looking at them. For example, I saw, I don't know whether you did, on Twitter, some stats from Statista on the deaths per million in various countries. And in fact, the UK stands at 92.53, but four countries much worse than that, five actually, the Netherlands, Switzerland, France, Belgium and Italy and Spain are all much worse in deaths per million. But the problem is, I think, Peter, you're right to call attention to who is being said to have died of coronavirus, because I think every country in the world is doing it a different way.
That is true.
We're hearing it from South Korea, for example, now, that they think that they are the patients who are becoming reinfected with coronavirus are not necessarily being reinfected, but they're actually, the virus is just kind of reappearing rather than coming back again. So what's happened there is they think that their testing system was wrong. So it may well be, and you're also right to say, you know, wait and see, because we just can't be sure, really, I think is the problem.
Well, I think the limit of our knowledge is the limit of our ability to discuss it or make policy. But I think we have to recognize here that the spread of viruses, as the fact which you produced earlier on about the effect of the sneeze, The spread of viruses is such an astonishingly potent thing, especially in an advanced urban society, that attempts by the state to control it are much like an attempt by the state to calm the Atlantic Ocean in a storm. We simply don't have as much power as we think we do over these things. And so and what there is no evidence of is that we've been able to exercise that power. Now, in that case, we have to look again at the proportionality of the measures which the government has been undertaking. And I think the government is doing this. One of the papers, I know that Matt Hancock denied this at a government press conference, which baffles me. But one of the things that has been considered at a cabinet committee and has been sourced, and I've checked this out, to a minister who's seen it, is a suggestion, certainly a projection, and projections, as we know, are not to be relied upon as fact, that as many as 150,000 people might die as a result of the shutdown measures that we've taken. Now, this is an immense number of people. And so, again, I have to stress, this isn't a matter of lives versus money. It is a matter of lives versus lives, that there are different effects on human life from different policies, and the policy being followed by the government has its dangers to life as well. So we, in judging whether we should continue that policy or whether we should quietly slip out of it and moderate it and bring the economy back to life before too much damage is done, I think we need to consider that point.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. But as far as the kind of the next step is concerned, you know, would you feel perhaps slightly more encouraged by the fact that other countries are beginning to look at lifting the restrictions? Because if we can see an end game and we can see perhaps if 11 weeks is the given amount of time that this takes to get through the system, which is what we're supposed to have learned from China. But as we both agreed last week, we don't really know if we can believe China. But say it is 11 weeks and say the Spanish lift their lockdown, but say the Danish lift theirs, other countries start to do the same thing. There will be something sort of, you know, almost sort of evidential that we can learn.
Well, I'm not sure about that. It's not for me to do anything which might discourage the government from beginning to moderate these measures, because I fear greatly for, as we discussed last week again, for the small businesses, for the people losing their jobs, for the people facing wage cuts, and for the very many damaging things which people face when we do eventually return to something like normal in terms of higher taxes, lower standards of living and everything else, which I think are very much coming our way and will be worse the longer this goes on. And I would not want to shout and scream, oh, you're in retreat at the government, because I would very much like them to retreat, and I would like to give them an honourable way out of what seems to me to have been a mistake. But in return, I would not want anybody to start claiming that the measures have actually been the cause of the eventual decline in coronavirus infections, which I think we will see. Because, as I say, there is no evidence of this. And I return to my metaphor that the patient goes to the doctor with chickenpox. The doctor says, if I cut off your right leg, then it will go away. He cuts off his right leg, the chickenpox goes away. The doctor says, there, you see, I was right. But, in fact, there's no connection between the cutting off of the leg and the chickenpox going away. But I don't want... I will not do anything to discourage the government by any kind of saying, look, they've made a mistake, look, silly fools.
Yes.
To prevent the shutdown from being moderated, because I wish to see it moderated.
But
on the other hand, I do not think that at the end of it, without any cause or even correlative evidence, that the government or anybody else should claim that this shutdown has led to the decline in coronavirus infections.
But as I said to you last week, I don't believe that the reasoning for the shutdown is to prevent death that is going to happen when people get the disease. What it's there to do, and what other countries have said it's there to do, is to try and relieve any pressure that might overwhelm the NHS. And that appears to have been successful up to now, because we get reports now from around the country that the NHS is coping. It is under pressure, but it is actually coping. And what we can say is that, therefore, if people were dying simply because there wasn't enough equipment for them to actually, you know, be given, for example, oxygen or ventilators because there were just too many of them, then it has worked.
Well, I don't agree, because it's the same argument, really. The argument as to whether the shutdown prevents infection is the same as the argument about whether it prevents death. Does the shutdown in itself hamper or inhibit or slow or stop the spread of infection of COVID-19? I don't think there's any evidence this is so. And until there is, I don't think anybody should claim that these actions have caused whatever may now happen. Of course, we don't know what viruses operate very strangely, and they're affected by all kinds of things, including changes in the weather, for instance. So we don't know what will happen next. But I simply don't think people should claim that they have done something when they have no evidence they've done so. If these infections are reducing and if deaths are reducing, then let us all rejoice enormously because that is good for everybody. But let us not make claims that can't be substantiated.
Now, a lot of the people that have enjoyed our little jousts on Twitter and on here as well, and again, I thank you, Peter, for doing it, and I think we should do it again next Monday, by the way.
I think I'd be delighted to do that. Yeah.
we've found a way of talking to each other without interrupting as well, which I'm very happy about. Here's the thing. If, for example, the question that a lot of people have asked me over the course of the weekend is, please ask Peter Hitchens what he would have done differently to what this government has done. Because what you seem to be suggesting is that if you had not locked down the economy and allowed the economy to continue, that would have been an improvement. But it could have cost a lot more lives, surely.
Well, it could have done, but as I say, there's no evidence that it could have done. And that is why I continue to say that I would follow the Swedish example, that is to say, of taking modest, practical measures without shutting down the entire economy and without forcing people into isolation. If you look at what's happened in Sweden, they have not done nothing by any manner of means. So, for instance, the senior members of the royal family are in social isolation.
Yeah.
And if you go to a bar in Sweden, you can't go up to the bar. You have to wait to be served at the table, and people are, in many cases, staying well clear of each other. But it's not been done in the same, how shall I put it, very stringent here. I don't think there'd be any scenes of policemen banging down people's doors or telling them not to go for walks in the country or whatever it is that we've had here. It's been a good deal more level-headed.
Yes.
And although the Swedish economy has, as all economies are at the moment, I would add, although the Swedish economy has undoubtedly undergone a reduction in activity, it's nothing like as much. As the reduction, the enormous public spending.
But they are very much.
We don't have, which we're engaging on here.
No, but they are very much out on their own there, aren't they? Because they're one of a handful of countries that have done that. Very few countries have done that.
In fact, in South Korea, they're now
in South Korea attaching wristbands to people to make sure that they adhere to the quarantine that they're in.
Well, I don't know particularly. I haven't looked very much at South Korea lately because it's problems to a great extent by comparison with us have been in the past up till now. There may be something in the future one doesn't know. I know a bit about Sweden. I know a bit about the Netherlands. Both countries in which the direction taken by Britain had not been taken. Of course, one knows a bit about Japan as well, where there's been a noisy adoption of a supposed state of emergency, which doesn't actually have any particularly stringent provisions attached to it.
But let's say,
I think now that we have, and last week when we spoke, and I'm very grateful to you, by the way, for correcting what you said last week, because it's really good when people admit.
What we had at that time
was that 99 people had died.
Yeah.
Sorry, 85 people had died in Japan out of a population of 127 million. It's now 135.
Yeah.
And these figures do not suggest that there is any connection between a stringent policy and a lower number of deaths.
That's true.
However, we have to face this.
Yes, but however, on Wednesday, after we spoke on Monday, they put much of the cities of Japan under emergency measures and declared a state of emergency.
Well, as I say, that state of emergency is largely symbolic and empty. The actual provisions of it are extremely weak.
Well, they're not extremely weak, but what I'm saying is they've recognised that something has to change. But in terms of the Netherlands, right, I said to you earlier that our deaths per million ratio is 92.53. The Netherlands is 121.93.
I think you'll find that the Belgium next door is quite similar.
It's even worse.
But the thing about Belgium is that Belgium has had a very stringent shutdown, whereas the Netherlands hasn't.
I think there must be something in
the... Whatever it is that's causing these differences, it's not the stringency of the shutdown, and that remains my consistent point.
Okay.
There's no evidence that shutdown does any good. There's a great deal of evidence that it costs a huge amount and damages greatly the economy that's involved. And again, I come back to my original argument from the very start. Have our actions been in proportion to the danger and have they been rational? I say not. In the answer to your listeners' questions, I would have followed the Swedish position. And I think the Swedish position has been wise. I think it's the Swedish position which has been normal. It's been all the other governments in the world which have taken measures unprecedented in human history. I mean, we've never before have we imposed quarantine on the healthy. No. Even during the great so-called Spanish influenza of 1918, the quarantining was done on the ill, not on the healthy.
Yes, but the quarantining in 1918 was a very different kettle of fish, surely.
I don't disagree.
Because
I'm
nowadays...
It's a different principle.
Right.
Quarantining the healthy is a different principle from quarantining the sick.
Yes. No, I agree with that. But the point is that we have a very different world now. I mean, one thing we've learned is that the pandemic spread of this disease was done entirely, and some people have made this argument over the weekend, because of the cheap cost of flying around the world. And so many people from China were in all sorts of other parts of the world spreading the disease, that could probably never have happened in sort of, you know, a century ago.
What was happening then was the very large numbers of people, particularly in the United States, were coming back from the European war.
Mm.
And so a lot of the figures that we have on the spread of influenza in 1918 come from that. And, of course, there is an argument that they largely affect those cities on the East Coast which first felt the arrival of the returning soldiers. In those days, people didn't fly back from Europe to San Francisco. They took the ship back to the East Coast, and then they took trains back across the country. So a lot of the interesting figures which are produced for that era reflect that as much as anything else.
Sure. Now, we didn't want to take a break while we were talking, so we've left that until the end, I'm afraid. So I've just been told that we're pretty much out of time. But I think this has been very helpful. I think it's been educational. I hope that you've enjoyed it. And I think the point is, Peter, that we don't know enough yet to be able to know whether this shutdown was a good idea or a bad idea. But I'd still rather be safe than sorry, as I said to you last week.
Yes, but as I said to you last week, what are you safe from? The economic damage of shutting down an economy, destroying so many jobs and small businesses, and of spending so much money we haven't got, is a huge threat to human well-being and health. We're not safe. This isn't a safe policy which we're following.
Okay. Well, thank you again. We'll talk to you next week. Peter Hitchens there talking from his position on the lockdown. He doesn't think it's a good idea. He still doesn't think it's a good idea. But some things have changed. Some things will change. We'll talk to him some more a week from now. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Let's talk to Callin, I think it is, in Edinburgh. Callin?
Hello. Hey, Mike, how's it going?
Yeah, very well, sir. What can I do for you?
Okay, so I wanted to pick up on two points. One of them was a good point that you made, I think it was about half an hour ago.
Yeah.
You were talking about the amount of people on the island and, like, the proximity at which that spreads the virus.
Mm.
And I was also wanting to talk about the possible app that would be introduced and how they interlock with each other.
Right. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, so first of all, you've got a lot of conservatives in the UK who are really worried about this app. Like, they say, oh, it's Orwellian, it's all big and scary because they're going to track all of our data. But those very same people are more than happy for the government to be demographically replacing them in their own homelands. And what you'll find is this actually interlocks with the point of proximity, because we have too many people on this island already.
Well, we have too many people in parts of it, I think. There's certainly no question that London is very overcrowded. I mean, where you are in Scotland, there's huge, vast spaces where nobody lives.
Mm. I mean, we're quite lucky up here, but our cities, like, if you look at any former English city, like London, Birmingham, or Manchester, or even you could say, like, Edinburgh, to be honest, that's actually not turning into a Scottish city anymore. And you'll find this has huge problems when it comes to...
There's a lot of Europeans in Edinburgh, aren't there?
Yeah, to be honest, like, yeah, there's a lot of European, but ethnically British people are becoming a minority in the Scottish capital.
Oh, yeah? Where's your evidence for that?
Well, you can see it if you walk around. Like, there's less British people, you know?
How do you mean?
There's less social trust. Like, people don't trust each other anymore.
How do you mean less British people? I used to live in Edinburgh. I used to work there.
Mm-hmm. Well...
Talking rubbish, mate.
No. Like, there is reason to this. If you go to Edinburgh... If you went to Edinburgh 50 years ago, you would see lots of Scottish people and there'd be a sense of community. People would look out for each other.
Did you go there 50 years ago?
No, but my...
So how do you know that, then?
I've seen photos of Edinburgh.
Oh, right. You've seen pictures. Good man. Yeah. Pictures of Edinburgh.
Yeah.
You can tell from pictures how friendly people are. You want a complete moron.
Like,
get off the radio, Callin. Get off. Get rid of that idiot.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. I'm delighted to say that we have now reached the point in the show when we do the homeschooling, because it's hard to forget that we are still dealing with this lockdown. We have still got lots of parents at home looking after their children, trying to teach them the ways of the world, trying to be teachers as well as parents, which is quite difficult to do if you're not really trained to do that. And I'm very happy to say we're going to speak now to James Max, Talk Radio's business breakfast host, and of course, a man that knows an awful lot about the business of business. James, a very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you, Mike.
How are you faring, Mr. Max?
Well, I'm faring pretty well, although the weather certainly took a turn this morning. My isolation walk was a very blustery affair this
morning.
It was
very windy this morning, and it dropped about 15
very, very
degrees.
Windy, yes.
Very windy indeed. Now, I thought to myself, now, you're the guy who's already given us a marvellous lesson in gardening and what people can do, so much so that my own son has cleared a whole entire section of our garden, which was previously kind of an old sort of chicken coop, which was just languishing away. And he's now going to plant a load of stuff in there. So thank you for that.
Fantastic. Pleasure. Anytime.
Yeah. And now I'm going to impose upon you one more time because of the markets situation. Because what I thought people would like to hear about is how the markets actually work. Not so much how they're doing, but, you know, I've had conversations for the past few weeks, obviously, about the markets in all kinds of different ways. And I wondered about the efficacy of keeping them open. But actually, I find it strangely kind of calming and reassuring that they are still working and that they are still going.
Well, indeed, the thing about the markets is that very often what we do is we talk about the index. We talk about the FTSE 100 or the FTSE 250 or the New York Stock Exchange, the Dow Jones. And we'd say, oh, they've gone up by X number of points, they've gone down by X number of points. But in fact, all of that is really quite meaningless because each index is made up of a constituent part. So funnily enough, the FTSE 100 is made up of 100 different companies. And in fact, those companies change every so often because it's the 100 most valuable companies which are listed on the London Stock Exchange. And what we see is that over a period of time, those companies will individually go up and down in value depending on how they're doing, demand right. and supply. And then that index is looked at as to whether it's representative of the biggest 100 companies, which are then listed on the stock exchange, because many more are listed in other indices because they're not quite as big. So they're all fighting to get into that top league. It's a little bit like the Premier League in football. Everybody's fighting to get in there because right. we have now entered an era when a lot of trading is done automatically. And yes. you might think, hang on a second, how can you trade automatically? This is bonkers. Mm. And to an extent, it is a bit, but there's so much money which is looking to get in there. And a lot of that money, by the way, belongs to you, and it belongs to me, and it belongs to all of us, either directly or indirectly.
Right.
So, for example, all of that money that's going into the market, a lot of it is made up of pension funds. So if you've got a pension, it won't be just sat there in money. That money that you have set aside for your pension has to go into something. And some of it will go into what's known as equities, i.e. these stocks and shares of the biggest companies. So some of those companies you will know and you'll recognise, and some of them, quite frankly, you won't have a clue, you've never heard of them. But it doesn't matter, because then what happens is that there is an allocation. So, for example, you can buy an index. So very often what pension funds will do, and the reason why this automatic trading happens, is because the automatic trading says match the market, follow the market, do whatever the market says it's doing. So whatever percentages are made up by the values of all of these different companies, your little index must match the performance of that. And so algorithms, these computer programs, then follow them, which is why we have this automatic trading, which is why when the market moves very substantially, it's normally because computers have put sell commands on certain things because they have a new piece of data. So all I'm saying is that these markets are highly automated. And yes, of course, as an individual, you can either try and break the market, you can try and do your own thing, you can try and trade differently. But a huge amount of trading is done automatically and on our behalf. So just coming back to that, because it's so important to understand why it matters to you and to me and to all of us, why when markets go up and down it affects us, is because when we see new pieces of data, so it might be an economic piece of data about market growth, it might be a new piece of legislation which either encourages or disincentivizes a certain kind of product, or, for example, data on a particular company on how it's doing, then suddenly all these algorithms change and then the market moves. And then if you're in the wrong place, you can catch a pretty nasty cold as a result of
it. And interestingly enough, a lot of these measures were put in, these automated measures were put in, weren't they, to stop massive falls and massive rises as well, because when it was the days of the good old Wild West, you know, when I was in Fleet Street and Wall Street was, you know, full of people like Leonardo DiCaprio, you know, basically it was a sort of, you know, a winner takes it all type measure. I remember reading a great book that my sister recommended to me called The Great Silver Bubble, when Bunker Hunt tried to corner the silver market and ended up losing out to such an extent that he was flying literally jumbo jets full of silver over into Europe, into Amsterdam, because he'd sold all this stuff and he had to sell it and had to actually deliver it.
Well, this is another thing that you mentioned, two really important aspects about the market. The first thing is that some years ago, back in the early 80s, I think it was, this thing called insider trading was identified, and then people realised that, in fact, it wasn't using market information to show how clever you were. It was using market information to recognise that there was going to be a major piece of news and therefore markets would move and people making a position beforehand. That is illegal. You are not allowed to use information that you have, which is proprietary to a company, before the market knows it. So that's one thing that has gone out. We've also seen a huge amount of trading by shadow markets. So people borrowing shares in order to have derivatives which are made off the back of these trades. It's enormously complicated, and I wouldn't recommend that anybody, unless you are an expert, gets involved in these, but you should know about this trading which goes on, because in fact away from the markets there's a huge amount of forward trading, people making speculative bids, people making calls, and it is very, very risky. And sometimes there are investors who say, oh, you can make a bundle of cash on this because look how you can chart your returns. You can buy these shares and you don't even have to own them. You can own a quarter of them. What they don't tell you is the downside, that if the market moves away from where you think it's supposed to go, you can lose a lot of money. It's a bit like, I suppose, gambling when it's sort of really on tilt. Because I think when people talk about investing in markets and they talk about the likenesses between gambling, then I get cross.
Yes.
Because it's not. When people talk about derivatives and when they're not an expert in how the market moves, that's akin to gambling, and that's when I think we get ourselves into big trouble. When people move from being a market investor to pretending that they can see where markets are going to move in the future,
yes,
that's when you have the real problems.
Yes, and funnily enough, one of the things, or two, a few of the things that I've learned, I'm sure I've told you about my sister who's been in the financial business all her life, and I still don't really understand it, even though she's explained it to me about a million times. But, you know, things like companies that hedge currency because they trade in all sorts of different countries, they sell their products in different countries, so they will buy sort of dollar futures, if you like, looking ahead to say, hoping that that will hedge against the price moving, which would affect, obviously, their exports.
Well, this is a really important part of the market. And in fact, there's a very reason why you would do that. So say, for example, if you are a company that uses international trade all the time, what you don't want to be exposed to is kind of a double dip into your profits. So, of course, if you were to use foreign currency, if you have certainty, then you can book the deal and you can book the deal at a certain price. So what people are saying is that in 1 month's time, 6 months' time, 12 months' time, we want to buy with our British pound a number of US dollars or euros or whatever currency it may be, and you can buy the price today, so you have absolute certainty. Now, what it means is that the person on the other side who's selling it that to you, they will possibly take an upside or a downside depending on where the currency is, and the markets look ahead. But for companies, that's taking the risk out. For you as an investor, it's taking the risk on the market for that period of time. So it's a really important tool that has made the UK one of the most sophisticated markets out there, because we have a huge expertise, particularly in foreign exchange, And one other thing that we haven't talked about at all, which is corporate bonds,
yes,
which is when a company borrows money because it thinks that the market can offer a better rate than just going to a bank. Mm. So a bank will say, yes, of course, Mr. Chemist, Mr. Manufacturer, Mrs. Car Maker, whoever it may be, you can borrow money from us. Mm. Here's the deal. And what they do is they say, OK, well, either we can take out a bank loan, or alternatively, we can issue our own corporate bonds, our own paper, we get them priced up, and then again the market is taking a risk as to whether or not that company can pay back that money at the end of it. And also, the higher the interest rate, the more likely it is that you as an investor are taking a risk. So all of these things, if you pair it back, what you're really doing, whether you're talking about equity, which is sort of money in, or debt, which is trying to sell on the money that you borrow, what you're really talking about is you're talking about risk. When you're talking about shares, you're talking about the risk that a company won't perform as well as it says it's going to, and therefore its dividend, the money that it pays out, a little bonus, is not going to be what it should be, and you're pricing it on that basis. And when it comes to debt, you're really pricing on the ability for somebody to pay back that money and to pay you the interest that you agree on that debt. So it's all about risk and return, and trying to analyze that and then come up with a price. And that's what the markets are doing. They're using their the huge bulk of transactions to price these different elements of risk in. So yes, they are forward looking, and to the rest of us who, perhaps if you're not in the market, understanding what they're doing is a bit bonkers, particularly when there were wild movements.
Yes, exactly right.
Normally, but those wild...
Sorry, go on.
No, it's normally those wild movements that are showing that the market can't price itself. It doesn't know how to price it, so therefore you have a wide variance of sales. When a market is working really well and people are fairly certain about the future, whether it's good or bad, that's when you get very small movements because people are able to price it in. If they've got no idea what's going to happen, and this is why we've got massive movements at the moment. So, for example, last week the FTSE 100 index, all the shares collectively went up by nearly 3%. Why? Right. Well, no one knows, really.
Well, that's the great thing about it, isn't it? Fascinating. We could probably explain this away for another 3 hours, but we've got to run. James, thank you very much indeed. James Max, Talk Radio's Business Breakfast host, back tomorrow morning, of course, at 5 o'clock. Money does indeed make the world go round, which is why I'm convinced that now the market should stay open, one, but also two, that no government around the world here is going to let the economy fall into rack and ruin. It's simply not going to let it happen. Why? Because it can't let it happen. It's as simple as that.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1 Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.